You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France, in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Liège.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in
Belgium.
Thank you. I was going to say we're in Flanders, but we're not actually, are we? We're in Limburg.
Oh, we're in Limburg, yeah.
Which is the Flemish part of Belgium, but not Flanders.
Boom. There we are. That's Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard.
I'm Richard Moore, and Francois Thomaso joins
there.
Us again. Hello, Francois. And we're out of Germany, and we are in Belgium, and we are quite close to Liège, where the stage finished today, and Marcel Kittel was the winner. Give us a tale of the etape, please, Lionel.
I will indeed, Richard. It was stage two of the Tour de France, from Dusseldorf in Germany to Liège in Belgium. It was 203.5 kilometres. As you said, Richard, Marcel Kittel, German rider with the Quick-Step team, won the stage. It's his 10th Tour de France stage win. It was a fairly formulaic day, wasn't it? Quite a lot of drizzle followed the riders from Germany to Belgium. Four riders got away. I said on the eve of the tour, speculating whether these stages would be dominated by breakaways featuring riders from the likes of Direct Energy, Wanty Group Gobert, Fortuneo, the French team, and Cannondale Drapac, and possibly Cofidis.
Hang on. Were Cannondale Drapac in your little selection?
I think they were, because I said Cofidis. Oh,
funny that, isn't it?
And I said
Amazing.
Maybe Cannondale might join in with that kind of Nostradamus.
The American team,
indeed. Well, anyway, the four riders that got into the breakaway were Thomas Buda of Direct Energy, Taylor Finney of Cannondale Drapac, Johan Ofredo of Wanty, Wanty Group Gobert, and Laurent Pichon of Fortuneo. And the thing that united those four riders all together is that they're all making their Tour de France debuts this year, which really surprised me, because I was sure Ofredo had ridden here before, but no, obviously not.
Never. Well, if you want the everything, Johan Ofredo is now 30, so yeah, and he's had a career behind him, so he should have ridden the Tour before. He didn't, for various reasons. First of all, he made his first impressions in Classics. Marc Madiot was a great fan of his at first. He was his team director with the FDJ, and really he decided that Ofredo should only ride Classics, and Ofredo liked the idea, you know, so he never actually begged for Tour de France places. And the second thing is, Johan Ofredo is kind of a maverick. He's had problems. Well, recently, actually, he was attacked in training in his hometown and was, badly injured. He was suspended for 1 year as well, not for doping grounds, but for failing to indicate, you know, where he was staying at the time. So he's kind of a very, very strange character, temperamental, very, very clever and interesting, but at the same time, he's had a very strange career, a very up-and-down career.
He's almost like the French Filippo Pozzato. He looks great on a bike. He's very strong. He's very good in the Classics as well. The tougher it is, the better. He rode well in Flanders this year, didn't he? Was it Paris-Roubaix? I can't remember.
The first time he made a name for himself was in Milan-San Remo, like 6 or 7 years ago, when he attacked just before the Poggio and on his own. And he's always been that kind of merry character. So and that's what he did today. He explained that very well. He said, you know, it's my first tour. First line stage, I had to do something, and he did.
Well, Richard, you mentioned that Ofredo may be the French Filippo Pozzato. That makes me Ofredo, very Ofredo.
Oh, my God, that's absolutely appalling. yellow card.
Okay. Well, anyway, the leading four, if we can return to the tale of the attack, they never really got more than, well, they didn't get an advantage of more than 3.5 minutes. The peloton was not letting them get any real headway. In the sort of the warming up stage of the race, there was a crash with 31 kilometres to go, and that involved Chris Froome and Romain Bardet, two of the favourites for the overall. But with the help of their teammates from Sky and AG2R, they got back to the bunch with relatively little difficulty. Chris Froome got a few scrapes and scratches, we think. Four-man group split down to two riders. Taylor Finney and Ofredo were homing in on the line, and their lead held up pretty well. They still had a minute inside the last 10 kilometres, and it was coming down quite slowly, perhaps a little bit too slowly for the bunch's liking. There wasn't really a concerted or organised chase by one particular team, but in the final 5 kilometres, that lead melted away, as so often we see, and with around a kilometre to go, they were caught and passed. And then a really chaotic, messy sprint, one where it looked like, you know, a crash might happen at any point. There was so much movement going on in there. Marcel Kittel looked like he had to come from quite a long way back. He looked like he'd been boxed in at one stage, but he had a lot of power over the last 300-400 metres and came through and won the stage.
Amusing comment on Twitter. Somebody said he was still in Germany with 600 metres to go. I can't remember who made that comment, but it was good.
Just on other bits and pieces from the race, Luke Durbridge is the third rider to abandon. He had a bad crash in the Stage 1 time trial in Dusseldorf yesterday. So Orica Scott lose a key man. Geraint Thomas still in the yellow jersey, of course. Marcel Kittel has taken the green jersey. Taylor Finney, his day out has netted him the King of the Mountains jersey, the polka dot jersey, because he won both of the fourth category climbs on the route. And Stefan Kung of BMC Racing is still the best young rider in white.
You mentioned the crash there, Lionel, didn't you?
I did mention the crash there.
I think I was looking up Juan Alfredo's results on in the Spring Classics while you were doing that then. But he was 14th, just to finish that little bit of business, in both Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. So strong rides there. I suppose the talking points were Kittel's win and the crash. A lot of people caught up in that. Echoes of 2014 for Chris Froome. A little bit different, but he had a crash early on in the Tour de France there, and that actually led to him abandoning the race that year. This was a little bit different. I don't think he's badly injured, but it is. He went down pretty heavily, and there is always this theory that very rarely do riders win Grand Tours after crashing. Alberto Contador at the Giro a couple of years ago is quite an exception. It does, whether you're hurt badly or not, falling at speed like that and heavily, it will interrupt his sleep, his recovery. All these things matter, don't they?
He looked okay when he was warming down on the bike outside the Team Sky bus after the finish today, but he gave very little time to. There was a big media scrum outside the Team Sky bus, as you'd expect, but was playing it down, brushing it off, which I'm sure he would want to do. He wouldn't want to stand and dwell on having crashed on the first road stage. But I think you're right, Richard. It's not ideal, but you know, very difficult to tell this evening exactly what the extent of his injuries are and whether it will hold him back or hamper him. We may find out tomorrow when there's going to be quite a testing, tricky finish.
I don't think it'll have an influence whatsoever, to be honest, because they looked. I listened to Bardet talking about it, saying he was okay as well, and even if it affected Chris Froome, it affected Bardet, who was a runner-up last year. Nairo Quintana was not in the crash, but he lost Alejandro Valverde. I think Amador today was one of his main guys in the mountains, finished at the back of the pack. So the Movistar don't look too good either. Richie is not the kind of guy who's going to get in the sprint and try to take any risk. He's a very conservative rider in this type of scenario. So for me, really, it was a rather boring stage, to be honest, like the classic stage with a long breakaway and the peloton waiting for the very last minute to catch the guys. Without that crash, we would have very little to say. But my impression is that it was not very serious. Then again, you never know.
Well, the winner, Rich, Marcel Kittel, is 10th Tour stage win. It was the result we were expecting, really. He's just a little bit further ahead of the other sprinters, but the riders lining up behind him it really does read like a bit of a who's who, doesn't it? Let's just have
they were all there,
French champion Arnaud Dumas, André Greipel, Mark Cavendish, an impressive fourth place.
Very impressive.
That shows that he is in good shape.
There was no reason
form.
For him to get annoyed at me last night in the little interview that we played when I suggested him that he could be competitive. There was no reason at all for that. He was bluffing.
But what was interesting was that no one team really took it on in that last 20 kilometres to bring Finney and Alfredo back.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because and Kittel made this point in the press conference that there are so many. When you think 10 years ago, there was one team. There was one team that was, well, 8-9 years ago, there was one team that was really in charge. And it was HCC High Road. The number of teams there with good sprinters, and they've all copied that HCC High Road system. They've got good sprinters. They've got teams to help them. But they're all very reluctant to commit because by committing, they're just helping the other teams. And they're all leaving it as late as possible. And Kittel said, we had a plan, but we couldn't execute it like we wanted. No team could. The reason the sprints are so uncontrolled, he said, was that there are just too many teams with sprinters. And it's an advantage, especially in a stage like today where it was a headwind, to come as late as possible. I mean, if you're out there in the front too early, you're going to sabotage your sprinter's chances. I mean, Sagan was caught out a little bit because he was left off at the front a little bit too early. Kittel came very late. That's the way to win. But it's risky because you can leave it too late. And you know, it's a tricky conundrum because there were two very, very strong. We'll talk a little bit about the breakaway in the next part and hear from Taylor Finney's mother actually, but. Two very, very strong riders, Joan Ofredo and Taylor Finney out front. 30 seconds lead with 5 kilometres to go is, you're beginning to think then it might be possible that they stay away. And it was in the balance.
It certainly was. Well, should we hear a little bit from one of Marcel Kittel's sports directors at Quick Step, Brian Hole?
Who wasn't in the team car today. He was wrecking the stage.
He was wrecking the stage and then watching the finish on the team bus. I grabbed a quick word with him at the finish. Brian, it didn't look like a conventional chase or a conventional lead out. How do you see the finish?
I saw it from our point of view. It was quite nervous. It didn't look too bright. I mean, Kittel, he was like boxed in the bunch, and we knew it was like 1.5% light uphill in the sprint, so it maybe fell still at a certain moment, and so it did. And it looked like Kittel did most of the work alone, and he came like, let's say, like Cav did last year, and he was strong enough to do it, search his way through the mess, and he was strong. It was sort of expected. I think people mentioned me as a favourite before the start, and they did a good job.
What was the discussion this morning? Because there wasn't much of a chase. No one team really took it up today, did they? It was lots of teams were doing a bit, but no one really put a full lead out.
At the end of the day, I think we got the best team here. We got the most winning team, and we probably got the biggest responsibility. So if we wouldn't have chased them down, it was probably us to blame. So even that, I saw with Finney and the guys, they did a good job. So I wasn't sure the last five. I wasn't 100% we would catch them, but we did.
But with so many sprint finishes, I guess you don't want to show your hand too early and say, "Well, we'll chase every day," because otherwise you might find that everyone always looks to you.
Yeah, and they always do. We're used to it. We always chase it. We don't really do that sort of Mickey Mouse cycling where we save ourselves. Well, we have a good sprinter, we always think we can win. And if we're dying, we're just dying with the boots on. We died before, but really calculating, cycling, saving. Honestly, we never done it. We're always riding from kilometer zero when we have to. Sometimes we make it, sometimes we don't. But I think we're one of the most winning teams this year. So I think we do something right, for sure.
I spoke briefly to Brian Holm as well, Lionel. And I told him that I was quite pleased because Marcel Kittel's in my fantasy tour team, I told him. And I don't think he'd heard of the... many of you will know we're running a little mini league, cycling podcast mini league on the Velo Games website. And Kittel is my sprinter in my fantasy tour team. Brian Holm didn't have a clue what this meant and looked at me very, very suspiciously. I had to explain. He said, "Sounds kinky." He said, "It's not at all what I meant.
That's a different kind of fantasy cycling team. Having a fantasy cycling team.
I just want
team.
Him to score points for me, and he did a great job of doing that.
Well, you had a terrible day on your fantasy team yesterday, whereas I did pretty well in the time trial. I think you're fine.
Napalms and Wyatt.
To be honest, I'm not in that fantasy game myself. I find it rather kinky too. But a quick one on Kittel. The good news for me, the interesting thing, no trains this time. For the past like 10 years, it was all about trains, and trains meant crashes because you saw these pile-ups with guys following their leaders, and if one had a problem, everybody, it was like, you know, a game of, everybody would clash in succession. These days, the good thing was it was all the strong men together, and only them in the finale, and Kittel has always been described as a sprinter who needs a train to deliver. He had no train today. He delivered, which says a lot about his current strength.
But the lack of lead-out trains and also the headwind is what resulted in a real sort of old-school sprint finish, wasn't it? With sort of six or seven riders all really close. He could thrown a serviette over the first half.
And the most clever sprint for me was Cavendish's. Actually, they were all together, the Demar, Sagan, in the same area. And Cav was, you know, a little bit outside of them, looking for another way to do it. So, once again, it might be to watch in the coming sprints.
Well, it's going to be very interesting because we are anticipating a lot of sprint finishes. Rolf Aldag said to me this morning, actually, that he's counted that there will be eight, and very unlikely that all of the likely sprint finishes are ones where the bunch would really have to take a day off in order to let a breakaway succeed. What is interesting, having talked to Brian Holm about who's going to take up the mantle of chasing and leading out, he really sort of played that down. It's almost like they don't need to necessarily do it. Will any one team want to do all that work? Will any one team want to do those lead outs? What we could see, rather than a sort of blanket victories for Marcel Kittel, we might see a number of the sprinters. The spoils may well be shared out fairly evenly amongst half a dozen riders.
A neat, interesting little point. I'm sure we'll get back to it at some stage. But the new 3 seconds rule, it'll take a little bit of time to explain. But this morning I talked to Yvon Le Danois, who is Richie Port, team director, and he said probably the 3 seconds rule that changed the approach in the final stretch means that the GC contenders might not be so involved in the sprints as they used to be in previous tours, might change the outcomes of the sprints, and maybe it did today because we didn't see any. Well, there was a rumor, as some said, that Fabio Aru was seventh, but it was, you know. Well, you know what I mean, but maybe it's changing the approach as well, and that's why we have the 20 best sprinters battling it out in the final.
Just to explain that 3 second rule for those who don't know, previously there would be a time gap given if there was a 1 second gap between the last rider of one little group, and if there's a mini split, there'd be, if that gap between the two groups is 1 second. The time gap wouldn't be 1 second. It would be from the rider at the front of the first group to the front of the second group. So a 1 second split on the road could lead to a loss of a handful of seconds, you know, 6, 7, 10 seconds. They've now widened the barrier, basically, so that the gap has got to be 3 seconds, and they work it out based on the speed of the finishing sprint and then convert that into distance and then look at the photo finish, don't they, and work out the distance. And if the gap's a 3 second gap, then they will give a time gap. But 3 seconds is a lot when
one second is about what, 20 meters or something
exactly
like that.
Yeah, depending on what speed they're going, but you're looking at a big gap there for this. So the peloton could be split into bits and pieces, but no time gaps given. And I think you're right, Francois, that might lead to a lot less desperate men from sort of 50th back, which is often where the big problems
happen. I don't like that new rule. But anyway, sorry about the dog trying to get in on the in on the podcast here. At the finish, I spoke to a rider who was up there in seventh, Ben Swift. Gave quite a detailed description of what happened at the end. He'll fancy his chances in some of the hillier finishes as well. But here he is from the UAE Fly Emirates team, Ben Swift.
Definitely fast. You definitely know you're at the Tour de France. It was fast all day. But yeah, I just took the decision to wait until the final 10K to really try and start to fight for position and just try and save my energies. And luckily, I was trying to look for guys that were almost like freelance also, you know, who were going to put themselves into the position so I could ride off the back of them. Luckily, I found Dan McClay in the final 4K, and you know, he's quite a big unit, so he makes quite a big hole in the air. And just in the sprint, it was really sort of like choppy left, right, break in, splits opening up in the middle and closing, and then that little tunnel with the uphill kick. But also, it was quite a headwind in the sprint, so it was actually quite a difficult one to judge. Found myself a little bit far back, so I made the effort. It's like either go early and try and put yourself into position or try and catch them off guard, and I went pretty early, but then you just had the wind in the head for the last 500-600, and luckily I had a second kick, and I mean, I can't complain too much when you're sprinting against these sort of guys and stuff like that.
And tomorrow, a stage that you've is it that one you've looked at and that you like the look of?
Taking it day by day in this race, I think definitely tomorrow's finish suits me a little bit better. It's going to be quite a tricky finish because also there's going to be a lot of sprinters and a lot of GC guys fighting for position there. So I think it's going to be a really intense finish. But definitely the finish with a little steep bit and then it flattens off before the sprint at the end. It could be quite an interesting day.
Hi, I am Marit Huisman, Country Manager Benelux, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to our generous sponsors, RAFA. We're very grateful indeed to them. They're doing quite a few things throughout July to celebrate the tour being on with a climbing theme. I mentioned the competition they're running for Cycling Podcast listeners last night. We will mention that again, but I'll mention something else tonight. They're challenging riders this month to climb higher than ever with a Strava Elevation Gain Challenge. Join the RAFA Rising Challenge on Strava and be in with a chance of earning a free woven badge or even winning a RAFA travel trip. Find out more at rafa.cc/RAFA Rising. A woven badge, it's a bit like the old swimming badge, isn't it, Lionel?
Well, it's a bit like in the early 80s before the Lycra jerseys, the old woolen Tour de France leaders jerseys would have a woven Tour de France badge and woven sponsorship badges on. I joked before the tour that the national champions only had a week to source their new national champion jerseys and get their sponsors logo sewed on, and you mocked and poo-pooed me.
Of course I did, because it was nonsense.
Before we move on from just mentioning RAFA, we should also say that we'll be taking nominations all week for our first pedaler.
Well, we should also say, and I forgot to say it last night, but our clothing is now available, our cycling podcast clothing on rafa.cc. You'll also, if you go click on the shop tab on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, you can see what's available. It's Pedaler de Charme themed stuff. It's a limited range to start with. It's very much a case of dipping the toes in the water and seeing what the demand is like. We really hope to add to the range, to expand it as we go on, and add women's clothing as well in particular. So give us your, tell us what you think and tell us what you want, and we will certainly pass that on to Rafa. And as I say, if demand is high, we will look to expand it and sell more.
Well, the Pedaler de Charme T-shirt or jersey. Well, there's a jersey.
Well, there's a jersey and a T-shirt shirt, and a cap.
And a cap,
casket.
Yeah, but we are awarding the T-shirt to the winner of the Pedaler de Charme.
It'll be ironed
each week.
I've got a travel iron for
the
job.
It'll be ironed, unlike at the Giro, where they got a bit creased in the back of the car, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But the thing about the Pedaler de Charme jersey is we want to award it to people who demonstrate charming pedaling, not just excellent cycling, but do something a little bit unusual
and
a bit offbeat, something that goes above and beyond. And
we'll be awarding this at the end of the week, and already nominations are flooding in for Taylor Finney.
Of course,
I vote for Alfredo personally.
Alfredo, I think Alfredo is a very, very, that's what I meant with the Posato reference, actually, their comparison. They look similar on a bike. They've got a very, very good style, very flat back, and Alfredo is a very stylish bike rider, and he looks good, doesn't he?
But in terms of the Pedaler de Charme jersey, I know in cycling there's always controversy about whether leisure cyclists should wear the world champion bands or the yellow jersey, and some people really frown upon that. What I want to make clear is that
absolutely fine.
It's absolutely fine for anyone to wear a Pedaler de Charme.
Honestly, buy as many as you like. wear a different one every day. That's absolutely fine.
But you mentioned Taylor Finney there. He and Alfredo, they were the men of the day.
Story of the day, wasn't it, Taylor Finney? Yeah, Taylor Finney suffered a terrible, terrible crash 2014 at the American National Championships. It took him a long, long, long time to just return to racing. Lost a lot of muscle in his leg. And, he's always been a rider of great promise, great potential. Always been talked up a lot, probably too much.
Well,
and
because of his background, obviously,
his
father was a pro rider. Well, hear from his mum, Connie Carpenter, who won the Olympic Road Race Championship in 1984. Davis Finney, his dad, won a stage of the Tour de France in Bordeaux in 1987, 30 years ago. So, you know, it's in the genes, obviously. But not just that. He showed his class very young age when he won an individual pursuit title on the track, a world title. But in the last few years, really, it's been his luck has gone from bad to worse. I mean, Geraint Thomas talked about being grateful that he wasn't on the receiving end of bad luck in the time trial yesterday. Geraint has crashed quite a few times in big races, but his ill fortune is nothing compared to Taylor Finney. I mean, even this year at Het Nieuwsblad in the start of the Spring Classics, he slipped on a wet step on the team bus and basically put himself out of the race. And then at one of the other Spring Classics, was it the Tour of Flanders, where he crashed while riding quite near the front of the bunch and gave himself a nasty concussion, missed a lot of racing for that. And this is his first Tour de France, overdue really. He's clearly got class. I mean, you say Alfredo looks good on a bike, but the pair of them together were really poetry in motion today, weren't they?
That might be the story of this beginning of the Tour de France, like revenge, you know, like Geraint had been, you know, tipped as being the guy who could take over from Wiggins and Froome as the next Team Sky team leader, at least in the Giro, and he failed to deliver, and then all of a sudden he's in the yellow jersey. And the next day you have Taylor Finney, who almost everybody thought was finished, who's back, you know, in the top, at the top of the race for at least 200Ks. Alfredo had the same kind of story, so maybe that's the kind of tour we can expect, and it will be very interesting to see.
I spoke to Charlie Wigelius, one of the Cannondale Drapac sports directors at the finish, and I asked him whether there was a moment in the finale that he thought that perhaps Finney and Alfredo might just do it.
There was actually, yeah. I'd say between 10 and 5 to go, the time checks were coming on the radio and they were holding the same. And, you know, you obviously expect them to incrementally just fall, but it was hovering there 55 seconds, 50 seconds. And you know, Taylor's got a big engine and came pretty close, so...
What did you make of the chase? Because it was a bit disorganised at times. That gave you the opportunity to have that bit of hope.
Yeah, I mean, there was the unfortunate crash there. But also, you know, the roads, wet roads, at times small roads, a lot of furniture, just fairly typical, Tour de France stuff. And that's what we always hope for. You know, I mean, something similar happened with Jack Bauer a few years ago, when it rained in the final unexpectedly and there was lots of roundabouts and he was basically doing the same speed as the peloton. So unfortunately that final run-in was fairly straightforward and the roads were in much better shape, but he did a really great ride.
It really was touch and go. The cynic in me, and I'm not even sure whether I should say this in public, but the time gap coming down on the screen, it really did make for a suspenseful finish. And I wondered, you know, are the broadcasters is the information,
accurate? I mean, Brian Holm, when I spoke to him, he wondered about that, and he said also, and this might have affected the chase, he said the riders' radios weren't working today, certainly in quick steps, so they weren't able to get information to them. But was the information accurate? I don't know. I mean, I thought the lead wasn't coming down very fast, and those riders, Finney and Alfredo, were riding at 50 kilometres an hour, 49, 50 kilometres an hour. So there was a chance, because normally, I mean, we talk about the plucky breakaways. These guys, these are classy, really good bike riders. I mean, and when you've got guys like that, it's a bit like at the Giro when Lucas Postelberger got away on that first stage. You know, a big engine. Not many riders could have done what he did. And when you give somebody with that talent just a half a chance, there's a possibility that the script might not be followed.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually, Richard, because this morning I was speaking to Rolf Aldager, the performance director of Dimension Data, and I did ask him whether the fact that the race is being broadcast from start to finish, whether that would have any bearing on the way the race is played out. And he dismissed that question pretty much and said no. And on day one, certainly, there's not going to be great tactical changes to the way the race is done. But I do think that by getting high profile, big engine riders like Taylor Finney and Johan Afredo in that break, giving it more of perhaps a chance to stay away to the finish. It wasn't, you know, I'm not being disrespectful, and I'm not going to be disrespectful about the riders from the smaller teams that do, you know, bring the race to life and perform a vital function, because otherwise we'd just be watching the countryside for 3 or 4 hours. But the Tour has fallen into this trap, and the Giro did it as well this year, where the riders from the world, the wildcard teams are the ones that do all of that attacking, and they spend a lot of time on TV, and it's all the old cliches about where they're giving their sponsors airtime and so on, so on. But really, they're just sort of moving wallpaper, aren't they? And I did sense maybe today perhaps that will be the beginning of something where bigger name riders will be required to go up the road earlier.
Once again, the bigger names in the break today were in smaller teams. So, you know, it goes both ways. And if it's true what you said, Richard, that the radios were down, at least for Quickstep or other teams, it proves once again that without the radio, when you have class and you have a little bit of a knowledge of the race, and I still believe a bunch as an instinct of what's going on, if really the radios were down, it proves once again that the peloton's instinct was stronger than just figures, SRMs or whatever, and radios. So the way it's always fascinating. Maybe it's a little bit silly. It's the poetry of cycling, and I'm overdoing it. But it's always a very interesting moment when all of a sudden the peloton, you know, goes back on the break, and these guys are swallowed and their dreams are shattered, and it takes place so smoothly, and you have the impression it's like an organic thing taking place. And once again, that's what's happened today.
It's like two drops of water being swamped by a big trickle of water, isn't it?
It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
That's poetry, isn't it?
That is poetry. And, well, you mentioned Lionel. I spoke to Connie Carpenter-Finney at the start. I was at the Cannondale bus. Charlie Wigelius was having a go on my Brompton, which I've been loaned for the Tour. Thank you, Brompton, for that. He wouldn't allow me to take a picture of it because obviously it was off message, but I've just said it on the podcast. Sorry about that. Anyway, up strolled Davis Finney and Connie Carpenter Finney, Taylor Finney's parents. And this was actually the only day that they're going to be on the Tour. They're heading off to Girona to stay in his house. And I took the opportunity to have a quick word with Connie, who, as Lionel said, was the Olympic Road Race Champion in 1984 and obviously a very, very good rider. And she had some interesting things to say. Here's what she said. Well, tell me, I mean, what's it like to be here and have your son competing in the Tour de France at last?
Well, of course, it's a dream for him to be here. And it's 30 years since the race started in Germany. And as history repeats itself, Davis started in Germany 30 years ago as well. It's great to be here. He's really excited. He's gotten a lot of support from Cannondale, and is really excited to be on what he's calling America's team.
Are you going to be on any of the rest of the Tour at all?
We'll come in and watch in the Pyrenees, and we're going to be basing out of his house in Girona and just see how it goes. But we'll be on the same time zone, let's put it that way.
How about you? Are you still riding your bike these days?
Yeah, Davis and I ride almost every day when we can, but not very far and not very fast.
You were the first ever women's road race champion at Olympic Games, weren't you, in 1984?
Yeah, first time the women's Olympics cycling event happened, I won it. We only had one race, and it's grown a bit since then. But women's cycling, I mean, I'd love to see the women racing at this level as well. You know, they certainly have the talent, and one day maybe they'll get here.
Women's cycling has certainly made a lot of progress recently, but, you know, here at the Tour, you're shaking your head. You think there's a long way to go.
No, I think women's cycling, we need, first and foremost, to put women's cycling on TV. You know, if we had the last hour of every big women's race on TV as we do the men, you watch the racing and it's really exciting, and the women are really of a high caliber. And I feel like we've just let the women down in favor of the pro side of the sport since the late 80s. And it's that we could do so much more, and the women's sport would be so much bigger if we had somebody pushing for them in those years. You know, I was kind of lost in space having children, and and, you know, by the time I surfaced and looked around, I was like, whoa, what happened to women's cycling in the 90s? You know, they really lost a lot of traction. And certainly it's coming back up, but it's just it's such a poor stepchild to the men's side, and I just don't think it's right.
ASO could do more, couldn't they, as a sort of premier race promoter?
Yeah, the question is it ASO, is it UCI, is it... I even look to our national governing body, or I look to Sky. Why does Sky start a pro men's team that's sponsoring their national team? They have fabulous women racing out of Britain, and they don't have a Sky women's professional team. They could have really set the bar high with that one. And so I think all along there's just been an easy out to say, oh, we don't have the money to do women's races or women's teams. But I think it needed to be legislated early on. You know, the reason women's tennis is so popular is because early on they made the agreement that the women would play best of three. They don't have to do the same distance, but they would have the same pay scale. And look where that is. People watch as much women's tennis as men's tennis. And I think the women deserve to be at this level. That women deserve to be seen.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast all year. A reminder that all our listeners can get 20% off at scienceandsport.com if you enter the code CPOD20. CPOD20. That offer applies to anything that isn't already discounted. CPOD20 at scienceandsport.com for 20% off. And we're going to be, as I mentioned last night, doing some Science and Sport nutrition-themed features throughout the Tour de France. Now, before the little break there, we heard from Connie Carpenter Finney, who obviously is here at the Tour supporting her son Taylor. They would have been enjoyed today immensely. He's in the polka dot jersey tomorrow. But she had some very interesting things to say about women's cycling and about Team Sky, something that I've always felt, certainly, that Team Sky missed an opportunity to really help themselves and help women's cycling by setting up a women's team.
Well, not only missed an opportunity, but back in sort of 2009, when Dave Brailsford was putting Team Sky together, he was asked repeatedly, will there be a women's team?
And he said, at the time, they had the Olympic road race and World Race champion Nicole Cook.
They did, and the likes of
Lizzie Rebecca Armitstead.
Lizzie Armitstead was coming through. They had endurance riders, you know, Joanna Rousel. I mean, there was a real a group of riders coming through from the British Cycling Academy, and way back then. I mean, we're talking now 8 years ago. Dave Brailsford said, yeah, when the time is right, I'm sure Team Sky will have a women's team. And while that wasn't a commitment to having a women's team running alongside the men's team, it was a kind of a, I now feel, looking back 9 years, it was a sort of a hold everyone at arm's length answer. It was kind of, well, you will have jam tomorrow sort of thing. And looking back now, it can only really be looked at as a bit of a fob off. And when you look at how much Team Sky, or rather Sky, has invested in cycling, it does seem quite odd. And Connie Carpenter really hit the nail on the head when she said what they could have done, what they could have created. They could have absolutely, helped women's cycling explode. The women's
Giro, the Giro Rosa, is going on at the moment. Hannah Barnes won today's stage. We've got a rider there, Alexis Ryan. I say we've got a rider. She's keeping a diary for us for reasons that will become clear a little bit later on. There are teams. Sunweb are one where there's a women's team and a men's team, and there's quite a lot of synergy between them. They go on training camps together. They support each other on social media and so on. That's really nice to see. Orica's another one with a women's team as well. Francis Dujeux now as well. It's good to see, and it should be a requirement, I think, of World Tour teams that they have a women's team as well.
It's fascinating to see you guys, the support Team Sky, the unconditional support Team Sky has for many years, and now, you know, realizing after a while that, well, they've been doing things wrong. And I'm not saying that, but it's fascinating talking about women's cycling, that Française des Jeux, of all teams, when Marc Madiot used 20 years ago on French TV, Marc Madiot, you know, talking to Jenny Longo, the most, you know, the most successful women rider ever, telling her, you know, go back home, you know, this is not a sport for you. And this guy 20 years later has a women's team when Team Sky
There's a fantastic quote from Mark Madio. I mean, I say fantastic. It's a terrible quote from Mark Madio about women's cycling, which I included in the chapter I wrote for the cycling anthology a few years ago about the Women's Tour de France. I think we've been pretty critical of Team Sky, Francois, when required, and just to carry on dumping on Team Sky in this part. I mean, it's not dumping on Team Sky, but the controversy over the time trial skin suits that they wore on Saturday flared up a little bit today. Some complaints from some teams. I think you've got some intel on that, Francois, aerodynamic features.
This morning, among some of the French teams, and not only the French teams, because BMC were very involved in that. There actually came Fabio Baldato, the BMC team director, and a guy from Française des Jeux, went to the commissaires and the president of the Tour de France jury, that Philippe Marin, who's a Belgian guy, to inquire on whether the skin suit worn by the Team Sky riders in the opening time trial were regular. And well, actually, the answer was I don't know. The head of the jury said, you know, it's not in my. I'm not able to tell you whether it's legal or not. It's up to the UCI to decide. And so, it was the talk of the paddock this morning. You know, did they use regular outfit or not? And I had a funny. There were apparently FDJ and other French teams have tried the same outfit that's called Vortex, and they've said, oh yeah, that's an enormous gain in time, and they were saying almost 20 seconds were gained thanks to this outfit by Team Sky riders in the opening. But in the same time, you had other guys saying exactly the opposite, saying, like Greg LeMond talked today and said that he tried the same outfit 25 years ago and it didn't work. So it's very difficult to say. The funny quote I had from Yvon Le Danois, who's another BMC team director, he said, well, you know, I'm not here to discuss that kind of thing. It's up to the UCI to decide whether it's legal or not. But if they decide it's legal, I can tell you what, in the penultimate day, the time trial in Marseille, we will all be wearing Vortex.
We should just explain a little bit about what this. I mean, I'm no tech expert here, but what we're talking about is a skin suit which has got panels on it which have a raised, bumpy, in a pattern, which aids the airflow across the jersey, across the body, and cuts through the air quicker, effectively. And all of this equipment is tested in wind tunnels. I mean, Rob Hales, who was a world champion on the track, spent a lot of his kind of the tail end of his career testing in the wind tunnel for British Cycling and testing equipment and clothing and seeing what, you know, computer modeling, what is the most efficient stuff to use. And when we're talking about Team Sky, Richard, you've talked before about British Cycling's modus operandi, if you like, which is to use some of this innovative new equipment in lesser competition and then have a situation where if they get challenged in a World Championship or an Olympic Games, they've got evidence and they can produce photographs.
Approved. Now, this goes back to the 1992 Olympic Games when Chris Bormann turned up in Barcelona with his monocoque bike. He'd never used it in competition before, I don't think, but Brian Steele, his lesser teammate, had used it in a World Cup or something, and he'd finished eighth or something, you know, raised no eyebrows at all, really got no attention. And so the bike had been approved. So when you turn up with the bike, now British Cycling with Chris Boardman at the head of, as their head of research and development, they did that before the Beijing Olympics, before the London Olympics, where they would test individual bits of clothing or equipment in competition, gather the photographic evidence that it was being used and approved. It's the same with this. I mean, Inner Ring has, the always excellent Inner Ring blog, has done a blog on this, pointing out that Geraint Thomas wore this suit at the Giro in the time trial, as did Andre Amador of the Movistar team. No doubt others have too, and we've just not noticed. It just doesn't get the same attention. I mean, there's no way that Team Sky would have turned up here at the Tour with these suits, having not checked or had gathered some evidence that they were actually legal to use.
It's interesting you mentioned Greg LeMond there, Francois, because of course 1989 was probably the most famous example of somebody unveiling a new piece of equipment in the Tour de France to such devastating effect, because he used the triathlon handlebars for the first time in the Tour, but they'd been used
the
before.
Tour de Trump.
They'd been used by the 7-Eleven team. Yeah. They'd been used by triathletes, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, effectively in those days, sort of amateur athletes. Really, they were a piece of kit marketed to triathletes, designed by a man who had experience of designing ski equipment. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of based on the ski top position, mm-hmm. isn't it? The triathlon bars. And there was a great controversy and hoo-ha on the last day of the Tour de France in '89. But the great sort of irony of that is that Laurent Fignon had a pair of these bars
and he
didn't use them, and he ended up losing the Tour by 8 seconds. And,
right.
you know, history tells us that now everybody uses them.
That's
and,
right.
You know, there was a period where they went for even more extreme positions.
There's a twofold, opinion to have on this about Team Sky. I like the way Team Sky are stretching the rules and trying to push the limits. It's what teams should do, actually, to try and it's even more than marginal gains. You have to come up with new stuff, new technical improvements, try to stretch the rules as far as you can. It's part of the development of the sport. But these days, whatever Team Sky are doing is the subject of criticism. That they've you know, gone from favor to out of favor, and if you know, if tomorrow they release new caps or whatever, there'll be somebody to say, oh, look at that, Team Sky have new caps, it's outrageous. Their reputation is because of the old TEU process and all this sort of, you know, all the problems that they had in terms of image in the last couple of years, mean that today everything they do is scrutinized, everything different. Even the fact that they have a white shirt now is kind of looked into as a possible plot or something. And I mean, that's what the Tour is about. It's kind of an amplifier of rumors of. I was about to use a word I'm famous for.
We all know, though, Francois, white is a faster colour than any other colour. That's just a scientific fact.
It's basically cheating,
fact.
Isn't it? I mean, should we leave it there?
We should, really.
We don't want to go on too long.
It's a long tour,
isn't
it?
It's a long tour.
We've
got to ease ourselves
to talk about.
We're going to have dinner as well.
We do need to have dinner.
Andouillette here, who knows?
Well, just on the dinner.
No way.
Yeah, tonight we're freestyling it, aren't we? Last night we were booked into a place by our friends at modernsalt.co.uk. It was a nice meal. You may hear a little bit more about that on one of our friends' specials that we'll release after the Tour de France, possibly.
The red wine was absolutely excellent. And I must point it out, as a Frenchman, drinking German red wine and finding it excellent was a real excellent surprise. I don't remember the name of the wine grower making the wine, but check my Facebook page if you are, you know, a friend of mine or not, because I put a picture of the bottle in it, and it's really, really good wine, Rotwein.
Great. Well, let's leave it there and go and get some dinner tonight, and we'll reconvene tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Thanks, you, Richie.